This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Jesse Hamilton McCoy II was raised by a single mom in a low-income neighborhood, in fact, a couple of them in Vance County and Durham counties, and becoming a doctor was going to be his way out. But a run-in with police in middle school set him on a new course. Today, Jesse is a housing lawyer and supervising attorney for the Duke Law Civil Justice Clinic. He focuses on a new eviction diversion program that aims to cut down the number of people forced out of their homes in Durham County. Jesse Hamilton McCoy II, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Talk about your earliest days, because you moved around as a kid, but I guess you started out in Henderson, right?
Right. So I was born at Durham Regional, well, at that time, Durham County General Hospital. And we moved a couple times from Granville County and then eventually to Vance County, where my mom found work. And when we were living in Vance County, I always tell people I was blessed to see sort of the best of times and the worst of times within that same area. So it was definitely a low-income area. But I remember when we first got there, there were a lot of seniors, a lot of very nice people. Folks would watch their other people's kids. And then, you know, one of the biggest changes was we had three factories. And two of those factories ended up closing, I believe, within a two-week gap from each other. So people went from being pretty happily employed and communal to desperation kind of setting in. And this was in the 80s at the same time where crack was being, you know, distributed within the community. And I got to see the rapid decline of an otherwise vibrant neighborhood. It went from being able to leave your doors unlocked and trusting the neighbors next door to watch your kids, to everybody kind of suspecting the next door neighbor of trying to break in to steal stuff. Nobody really trusting anybody with their kids anymore. And even the character of the neighborhood changed with individuals who became susceptible to crack addiction. And as a result, would terrorize the kids for money, for lunch. They might break into people's houses, steal things from people's cars.
And you were, it's not just people's, but you were a victim of some of this too.
Right. So, there was I would say he was in his 20s, a guy by the name of Anthony. And he used to pretty much terrorize the kids. He was a very bad drug addict. And he had these two Dobermans that he used to have on his porch, and he would let them go on kids as they're walking to the bus stop, which is about three blocks away. And I remember one morning, it had just iced over. It was a very cold day. And I was walking downhill to the bus stop, and he saw me coming. He let the Dobermans loose, and they came running for me. And I tried to run, but I slipped on ice, and I fell. And I still remember to this day the feeling of the Doberman getting closer and closer and closer. And fortunately, I had a neighbor who was in a car and honked the horn, and it made the dog run away, I guess, who was scared of the horns. But I could remember just his laugh and the things that he would do. I mean, he got a kick out of this stuff. And ultimately, he ended up, this was, you know, going back in the days of Tandy computers, if you remember.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Tandy computers were the new wave, and they had just been introduced to a local middle school that was not too far from where we lived. And he actually broke into that middle school attempting to steal the Tandy computers to sell or whatnot, and he ended up cutting an artery in his arm and bled to death.
This is a remarkable transformation that you're seeing just as a young man from this community that overnight becomes a place where, as you say, you keep your doors open to this kind of thing. Your mother is not unaware of this. She's working. In fact, she's working a few jobs now, right? Tell us about her and what's happening to her through all this.
So I love my mom primarily because she was always focused on education and always focused on self-improvement. My mother came in and she was a guidance counselor for an elementary school, but she had owed from several loans she had taken out before for education and some other things that personally had gone wrong. Of course, with her, my father not working out and just trying to kind of get herself back into a good starting position. So she took on other jobs as a front desk hotel clerk, also working in fast food. And because she had three jobs and she was trying to focus on getting us to a better place, oftentimes there were occasions where she's not going to be there with me. And for our situation, she did have a next door neighbor who she entrusted with my care. You know, once it got dark outside, I was supposed to go over to this person's house. Part of that, I do believe, created a strain on our relationship, just to the extent that you get used to doing things on your own. You get used to isolation. I never had any brothers or sisters or father or grandparents or anything like that. So in that isolation, you kind of have to find creative things to keep your mind busy. And because my mom really believed in education, anytime that the school was discarding books, she would collect those discarded books and bring them home for me to read. Anything that she came across in reading, she would bring it home, particularly books dealing with Black identity or who am I supposed to be as I grow into manhood.
And she did more than just put them in front of you and hope that you'd read them. I mean, you were essentially on lockdown, and she made sure, right? There were quizzes about these books, right?
Correct. I would have to do reports for her about what I took from a story. I think part of that was just to ensure that I was actually doing the reading, not saying I did.
And not out on the streets, right? Unless you're reading under a street lamp, you know, you're home where you're relatively safe.
Absolutely, absolutely. But the spillover benefit that she probably didn't see coming was that it really engaged my curiosity and wanted to do my own creative ventures, like wanted to do my own writing. Because I would read all these great books, didn't really have a social context for why they were written the way they were, or know anything about the people who actually wrote the books. But I would just read these things and say, huh, I could do this. It's very possible.
You, in fact, you did when you got to, was it high school? You started writing books, or at least wrote one book that went viral in its own way.
Right. So I started writing in middle school. For the reason that all teenage boys write, I wanted girls to like me. So I wrote in middle school, and I did a lot of like romantic comedy books because there was this whole Eric Jerome Dickey phase. I just met Eric Jerome Dickey. I thought he was the greatest guy in the world. He autographed my book, and I said, I want to be like him when I grow up. And so I wrote novels that basically showed different personalities that I always counteracted in school, and I would just mix them together. And people would get a kick out of basically sending my book around to everybody in the class. There was only one copy of it, and they would try to identify who was their character. So everybody, this is middle school.
Right.
Right. So everybody wanted to find out, oh, the cool guy, that's got to be me. That's and it ended up just taking off. Like when I saw the reaction that I was getting from something that, you know, it was just a hobby for me. I said, wow, people are really interested in reading something that, you know, maybe is more accessible to them because it's being passed around in the school, or maybe because it just evidence is something different from what the school curriculum was trying to provide.
And talking about school, you changed schools. You went from a predominantly Black school to a predominantly white school, and that transition had an effect on you. Tell us more about that.
So I grew up in Henderson, North Carolina, and in Henderson, North Carolina, despite the fact that this was the 80s, it was still very segregated. In fact, some would argue if you go up there now in 2018, it's still very segregated. Mm-hmm. And so at the time, I initially started at Pinkston Street Elementary, which is what they knew at the time as the Black elementary school. But by fourth grade, I was going over to E.M. Rollins, as I guess they had increased their intake of students from across town. And surprisingly, I was you know, average student at Pinkston Street. When I get to E.M. Rollins, I actually place for academically gifted, which was news to everybody who knew me. And part of it was they were starting this program that was kind of an experimental program to give 4th, 5th, and 6th graders exposure to a college curriculum. So the things that I was learning about in fourth grade were things that I didn't see again until I got to college. The Bolshevik Revolution, the rise of Vladimir Lenin, what is Marxism? Things like that. Wow. Just anything from the early 1900s. Mm.
What if the Mensheviks had won? Well, never mind. Let's get into that later. Tell us more. So this is amazing because this really is counter the trend. We know there's plenty of evidence to show, on the contrary, that African-American students are misplaced and often, not often enough placed into GT. But there you are. And so now you're exposed to all this great stuff.
And I love the way that the class was set up, because one day you would have history and social studies. The next day you would have life skills courses. So I learned basic things like how to play chess. I learned there. How to cook. I learned there. And with all these different experiences, when you would go back and return to the neighborhood that you come from, you just feel different. Like you don't feel like you fit in anymore. Mm-hmm. The stuff you have to talk about, nobody else knows what you're talking about. They're looking at you like an alien. But what I think wasn't expected was that I started kind of relaying these parallels to what I was seeing or reading in the books. So for me, Tsar Nicholas II and his family's execution shows a completely different trajectory for Russia than the rise of Vladimir Lenin, and what the people were trying to encourage at the time who were inspired by Vladimir Lenin. And the parable to my community seemed like it was so concrete. It's like, look, people want an opportunity. And for so long, people have felt like they've been voiceless, they've been unheard. So in a sense, that kind of was a foundation for me wanting to provide a voice. But it would be many years later before it would actually snap into me that I need to do that.
We will talk about the years that intervened and what it led to in my conversation with Jesse Hamilton McCoy II, housing lawyer, supervising attorney with the Duke Law Civil Justice Clinic, focuses on eviction diversion, aiming to cut down on the number of people forced out of their homes. That conversation continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, meeting Jesse Hamilton McCoy II. Jesse is a housing lawyer and the supervising attorney with Duke's Civil Law Justice Clinic. He focuses on an eviction diversion program that's trying to cut down on the number of people who are forced out of their homes in Durham County. So we were talking about your growing up in Henderson, going to a school that ultimately got you ready for college, and the important role that your mom played. What about your father in all this? What's your relationship with him?
So I've never had a relationship with my father. And until recently, I wasn't even aware that he existed. I ended up coming into contact with a sister when I was about 15. I was working at Chick-fil-A here in Durham. And I had a manager who came in and said, "Hey, your sister's in the front." And I thought it was a joke because, I've never been raised with any sister. I don't know any sister. So when I went up to the front counter, she just kept remarking about how I looked just like her father. I wasn't emotionally mature enough to handle that. So I stormed off, basically called my mom. I felt like there was this big conspiracy and I didn't know. And I wouldn't hear from my sister again until about a year ago. And a year ago, she reached out to me via Facebook, got in contact with me, and let me know, she was the same person who had tried to get up with me when I was 15. She introduced me to an older brother that I didn't know about, and we met for lunch maybe sometime in the winter last year. Yeah. And it's weird because everything that you feel like you know and you've gotten comfortable with knowing about your life and your upbringing, it kind of shifts because their stories about who my father is a completely different biography than what I had been told or what I was exposed to.
Well, what were you told?
So what I was told was that my father had had some military service, but had gotten himself wrapped up in some legal issues along the way. I wasn't told exactly what those legal issues were, but I was told that perhaps this was part of the reason why he wasn't involved with me. But what I found out from the two of them was a very different circumstance. One actually lived with him and grew up with him and says that he was in the military and they lived in Germany for 8 years and had a great life for all intents and purposes. The other person says he was never a really hands-on father, but he was always there for money or just advice. And these were things that I've never personally experienced.
You know, this would be shocking for anybody, but for a guy like you who's just described the fact that you're able to put things in context, you're able to make these comparisons and say, wow, that situation in 18th and 19th century Russia looks a lot like in early 20th, what's going on here. You're always putting things in context, and as your story goes on, we'll hear more of that. So this had to really rock your world because you had a nice context, and all of a sudden somebody blows it up on you.
Right, absolutely. But, you know, like, I'm at an age now, being 35, that I can understand that people make mistakes. Mm. I can understand that people aren't always as forthcoming with acknowledging those mistakes. Mm. And from what I hear, there may also be some issues about mental illness and mental health that he may be dealing with as well. I still have not met him. I think they're trying to get me to extend that olive branch, and that's probably going to be a process for me to get to that point. But I've at least resigned myself in the fact that, you know, there can't people, everybody can have multiple stories. And just because you see one side of a person or don't see a person at all doesn't necessarily mean that that's the end all be all for who they are.
Well, that brings us right up to the present, but we still need to get there. We left you in Henderson, North Carolina. You were going to school. You talked about the neighborhood. Things were getting worse and worse. And finally, your mother decided it was time to get out. What happened?
So the whole time we were in Henderson, my mother had been working hard to get money together to come to Durham. I had an aunt who was diagnosed with breast cancer, and my mom wanted to be closer to her sister. Also, Henderson at that time wasn't getting any safer. And so we moved in, I believe, 1995 to Durham County. When I came to Durham County, I went back to being placed in regular classes. So you go from 3 years of academic giftedness and all the things that came with it, the trips to Yorktown and Jamestown and feeling like you have a tangible history, to going back to basically worksheets. And you don't feel challenged. But I also met people who at that time in Durham County were involved in a lot of different activities outside of school, some of it positive, some of it not so positive. And one of the things that really was interesting to me was the game of football. I was fortunate enough to go to Carrington Middle School, which was undefeated for like 30 years in football, and I wanted to be part of that tradition, so I did, and had a great time. But in middle school, I had my first run-ins with police. Some were very positive run-ins, and some were very negative. But as with anything, the negative tends to stick out a lot greater than the positive. One such instance was when I was coming back with a friend from getting groceries. We used to go to the grocery store on Saturdays for our moms and get whatever that they needed us to get from their list. And when we were coming back with our hands full of groceries, a police car pulls up, cuts on the siren, stops us. Police gets out the car, asks us why we were throwing rocks in the road. Now, keep in mind, our hands were full of groceries. Mm-hmm. We weren't throwing rocks. We naturally believed that maybe he was confused and he thought it was somebody else and he just confuses. But quickly it escalated to the point where we were being stuffed in the back of a car and we thought we were going to be arrested, but we weren't arrested. He just rode around with the sirens going off until there was a nice crowd of people in the neighborhood and then opened the door and let us out with a stern warning about don't do this anymore. Don't throw rocks. And it was one of those situations where you could see the look of shame on everybody's face. And it was so misplaced. We felt like we wanted to take a stand against what this officer did to us. But you don't really have any mechanism to do that. You can't, you know, curse out the officer, certainly. And you don't want to do it in a crowd of people. And it was just like it was one of those things where it felt like we were supposed to accept that this was the way it was going to be. But I remember that feeling, and I knew from what other people had told me from their run-ins that this wasn't the first time, and there was a growing sentiment of people who felt voiceless against law enforcement wrongs and law enforcement overstepping on their rights and abilities. And I said to myself, you know, I want to be in a position when I grow up where I can actually represent this community. I can actually stand up and voice this community, stand up to bad law enforcement officers. And it's not against the good law enforcement officers. We love you guys. But for bad law enforcement officers to actually stand up against them and expose what they're doing and equalize the playing field, so to speak. And so that was really when I shifted my career decision from being a doctor to one to be an attorney. And that was only the first. I had another run-in later on when I was in high school, and I was working for an anesthesiologist in a health professions partnership initiative program at UNC. And I had an officer from Chapel Hill Police Department who came and found me walking into the McNider building behind Health Sciences Library and actually slammed me into the brick wall of the Health Sciences Library, saying that I looked suspicious and I must have been stealing computers, which I had nothing but breakfast in my hand. And it wasn't even my breakfast. It was the breakfast I was bringing back from the doctor who sent me to go get it. So that was a big deal. The doctor was livid. The coordinator of the program was livid. And at the time, I don't think I really understood the gravity of what had happened because I was so accustomed to these kinds of things happen.
Were you studying science at the time? Had you thought about law or pre-law because you were doing research? Were you actually studied chemistry?
So I studied chemistry when I was in college. That was my initial my initial degree opportunity. And one of the things I quickly learned was chemistry, as much as I loved it, it did not love me. I did not perform well in any of the chemistry classes despite dedicated efforts and hard work. And it turned out that because I was a scholarship recipient for the college that I was at, and my scholarship was in jeopardy with me being a chemistry major, I took a long look at my transcript and I said, well, the only thing I've gotten an A in and that even looks like a good grade is English. So I'm changing my major to English. And the thought at that time was, well, it's English. It can't be as hard as chemistry. And it turns out I was wrong.
Okay. The story is more understandable to me in English than it is in chemistry. But I take your point. Were you still writing at the time? Because, again, you had these wonderful stories going on in middle school. Still writing in college?
Absolutely. College, I kind of stepped away from my traditional like romantic comedy side. And I started trying to experiment with adventure novels, epics, things that I felt like were going to be stuff that I wanted to read. And primarily my basis for that was because I was an avid reader and I loved both Borders Bookstore and Barnes & Noble Bookstore. I was a huge fan. But when you would go to these stores and you would go to the African-American literature section, what you would see is limited selections. And what I mean by that is it's easy to find slave narratives. It's easy to find kind of the drug dealers, boyfriends, girlfriend, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's easy to find crime novels. It's easy to find erotica. And you'll find biographical pieces about great African-Americans who've existed throughout time. But what you don't see is the things that I really loved in fiction. You don't see black mythology. You don't see just a black family in a book and the things that they go through. You don't see black historical fiction. So I said, okay, well, this doesn't exist. And there could be one of two reasons. Maybe this stuff doesn't sell, or maybe nobody's tried. So I don't want the excuse to be nobody's tried. Let me start writing it and see what happens.
So you get a lot of threads going on. You start out wanting to be a doctor. You get into chemistry. You're still writing. You're very interested in the kinds of fiction and literature that you want to produce. You're studying English. Is law still sort of rattling about in your mind?
So the university that I went to, Florida A&M University in Tallahassee, Florida, had this thing called Law Day that I was exposed to my freshman year of law school. They did it at that time every October, and a representative from every law school in the United States, it seemed like, would come to Florida A&M for the purpose of recruiting students who were interested in going to law school. And so, of course, being from Durham, the first person I saw was somebody representing Duke University's law school. And I instantly made contact with them. This guy by the name of Dennis Shields in their admissions department. And he was very nice. He told me everything I would need to do to go to law school if it was something that I was interested in. And from there, we began essentially a 4-year relationship where I would just come in October, update him on where I was, what I was trying to do. And he would say, okay, well, just make sure that you do well on these tests and that you continue to do well in school and apply. And, you know, good things should happen. People may not know, to become a lawyer or to get into law school, you have to take a test called the LSAT. And the LSAT is a very expensive test. Now, the benefit for me is when I was in high school, I always qualified for waivers of the fee for the SAT. But in college, I did not. And because I did not, I could only afford to take this test once. And I always told myself, if I only have one opportunity to do it, I want to go all in. So I took the Kaplan class, the Princeton Review class, everything.
These
so
are all prep classes for the LSAT, right?
All prep classes for the LSAT because I wanted to kill the LSAT, get a great score, and get into Duke and go on to do great things. So I go, I study, I take the LSAT. And when I take the LSAT, I get my scores back, and I am horrified. Mm. And just so people know, because this is a motivational story wrapped up in a historical story, I scored a 132 on the LSAT. Okay, and I'm not a dummy.
What's the high score?
The lowest score you can get on the LSAT at that time was like a 128.
Oh, goodness.
Yes, so very low. But because I'm confident, I still went to Mr. Shields with my 132, and I said, well, Mr. Shields, this is what I have. And he says, oh, no, you can't do this. You need to take this test again. I said, well, Mr. Shields, I can't afford to take this test again. This is what it is. He says, well, no, this isn't going to get you into Duke. And so at that time, I thought, you know, we built a four-year relationship. At this point, I'm just not going to get into law school anymore, so that's it. And I had some very helpful teachers at Florida A&M who were like, look, you need to keep applying. But I just was kind of giving up at that point. And as I'm walking out of law day, I see a lady and her daughter, and they look lost. So I asked them if I could help them find something, and they were trying to find the administrative unit at my college. And I said, well, sure, I'll walk you there. So while we're walking, the older lady says, hey, I saw you coming out of law day. Are you interested in being an attorney? And I said, well, yes, ma'am, I am. She says, okay, well, where are you from? I said, I'm from Durham, North Carolina. She says, oh, have you ever heard of North Carolina Central University? Absolutely. Like, I grew up in Durham. Everybody knows North Carolina Central. She said, would you go to law school at North Carolina Central University? And I said, well, absolutely. I'll go to law school anywhere if I can get in. And she says, okay, go to your dorm, get all of your information, and give it to me. So I did what she said. This is a complete stranger. I'm giving her social security numbers, everything. But I give it to her, and she says, you'll be hearing from me. And less than 3 weeks later, I had my acceptance letter to North Carolina Central School of Law. Come to find out, she was one of the outgoing associate deans of the law school, and her daughter was interested in coming to the college that I was at. So it just worked out.
Well, so then you go there and you become it to talk about the experience at North Carolina Central, because community involvement, community engagement is a big part of what that law school does, right?
So North Carolina Central is a great law school, and part of what makes it so great is that it is very academically rigorous. What I mean by that, for people who don't know, most folks, if they're in high school, particularly if you're like me, you may not have necessarily had to work very hard to get A's, but you get them. Then you go on to college and you got to work a little bit harder to get A's. But hey, you know, you still do well with pretty much, you know, maybe a solid 60-70% effort. You get your A's. Law school is kind of like being an MBA. Everybody's a pro. Like, everybody's great. And it's not like you're getting graded based on a system of how you perform. You're getting graded on a system of how you perform in comparison to the rest of the class.
And they're all top-notch to begin with.
And they're all top-notch people. On top of that, I had a lot of personal anxieties about law school. So people from my communities don't typically go to law school. We don't typically go to college. So I felt like I didn't belong. A lot of people you go to law school with, their parents are governors, senators, and half of them, they don't even really want to go to law school, but this is what their dad told them they're going to do if they're going to inherit anything. So, you know, me wanting to be there made it seem like I had so much more catching up that I needed to do. And so I went into this program, And my first semester there was not good whatsoever. It's like learning the alphabet all over again because they're training you to think like an attorney. And I didn't do well. So I became a poster child for academic support. Any additional help I could get from any dean, professor, assistant, that's what I did. And I would come back and encourage other people to come and get help. I ended up staying in law school because, you know, we have a huge attrition rate at the end of that first year. I ended up staying primarily because everyone knew my work ethic. Everyone knew that I was giving it my all. And everyone knew that I was going to make the most of the opportunity. If I can be here, I'm going to do it. But I had to do law school my way. The other thing is I've always been community driven only because I feel like, you know, if you look at the history of North Carolina Central, it was founded as a law school for people who weren't allowed to go to law school in other places, primarily because of race. So my thing is, if that's the case, then the law school should have some kind of vested interest in ensuring that the community that we're representing has advocacy. And I wanted to make sure that we didn't get so bogged down in focusing on, you know, torts and properties and contracts that we forget the bigger picture of why we're here. So ultimately, in so doing, I was able to do pro bono work under the supervision of attorneys in the area. And I interned at the office of NAACP with Reverend Barber. And I was able to get a lot of good legal experiences that I felt like helped the community. So much so that my final year of law school, the student body actually entrusted me to become the student body president, student bar association president for the school, and represent student interests to the administration and the community.
We'll talk more about that and those experiences and what they led to when my conversation with Jesse Hamilton McCoy II continues. He's a housing lawyer and supervising attorney with the Duke Law Civil Justice Clinic, and our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, meeting Jesse Hamilton McCoy II, a housing lawyer and supervising attorney with the Duke Law Civil Justice Clinic. It's a clinic that works to cut down the number of people forced out of their homes in Durham County. We're talking about you going to North Carolina Central Law School, challenging at first. You made your way through. By the end, you are the president, student body president, or the president of the law clinic?
Student Bar Association.
Student Bar Association. But you also had an experience going down to Gina, Louisiana, a very famous protest, infamous story down there. Remind us of the story and your involvement in it.
So we put together an organization of students to go down to Gina, Louisiana, and show support for the students who had been arrested following a fight where there were nooses hung from trees in Gina, Louisiana. One such student was Michael Bell. And Michael Bell had been arrested, you know, essentially for stuff that we had already kind of been arguing against up here.
I mean, give us the details of that. Yeah.
So essentially, from a legal perspective, there's a movement, it seems like, going on where if people are involved in a school fight, back in the day, those things used to be handled through a trip to guidance or a conflict resolution or maybe even principal's disciplinary imposition. But now there's a movement to push all those students into the justice system. And a lot of people refer to that as the school to prison pipeline. We felt like, A, there was a fight at this high school in Gina, Louisiana that seemed warranted because it was based on the fact that there were nooses hung up and racial epithets that had been scrawled throughout. And these students were essentially not taking it. They were standing up against that. But it resulted in their incarceration. And again, we have this other issue with bond amounts that aren't going to be reduced or bond amounts that are excessive for the people that are being held and for the charge they're being held for. So there was, at least at that time, it seemed like there was no way that this guy was going to be released. And so what we did was, you know, I thought as SBA president of a historically black college, we can't sit on the sidelines for that. We can't be quiet. I didn't know anything about Gina, Louisiana. I didn't know anything about the government or anybody we could call. So I said, well, let's just go down there. And when I presented the idea at the time to the dean, he didn't think that it was a good use of our resources and time, only because we're supposed to be law students focused on our academics, which I totally understand. But I felt like this wasn't something that we can just overlook. So we were able to get some charter bus companies in the area to actually donate some buses for us to ride down to Jean, Louisiana. There were about 50 of us. And when we all had our North Carolina Central Law School T-shirts. And when we get down there, I was impressed to see the number of media outlets that were there. So I began just delegating people to go talk to different media outlets. We had BBC, CNN, a lot of morning show, radio shows. And we just delegated. And in so doing, we happened to meet people like Jesse Jackson, Michael Bazden, Al Sharpton, just folks who were there. But primarily, the people from Jena, Louisiana seemed so happy to see us, so happy to see a historically black law school showing some degree of representation just by being there. So we, after the interviews, we marched onto the courthouse, and the news came out at the march that all of a sudden they were going to release Michael Bell. So everything turned into a celebration. Of course, we had to get back on the bus to come back. So this was just all in the course of one day. And when we get back to the school, despite some initial opposition from some of the administration, we saw that all of the professors and students had decided to wear black armbands and black T-shirts in solidarity for what was going on. And it was a really good emotional sight when we got back from Jena. But it was that experience that let me know that I feel like I'm put here to do something greater. So after 4 years of private practice in my own firm in Raleigh, doing mostly criminal defense work and personal injury, I ended up accepting a position with Legal Aid's Winston-Salem office. They initially placed me in the domestic violence unit. So I did a lot of advocacy for victims of domestic violence. And I got exposed to so many great stories, like harrowing stories about women. You know, I had one client who walked out from a small town far, far away from Winston-Salem, thumbed a ride with somebody, and just left her kids, left everything to get away. Mm-hmm. And then once she got to Winston-Salem, she didn't have a place to stay or anything. So we took her from being just somebody walking around on the street to getting her into a shelter. And less than a year after we were able to get her a restraining order and find her some resources, she was actually teaching the class for those women who were also being abused and telling them about her personal story and in an effort to encourage them. And stuff like that is powerful to me.
But not all the stories have a happy ending, and one of them disturbed you deeply.
Correct. So one of the things about me, particularly when I was young in the practice, is that I'm big on relationships. And so I had a client who I had helped her win her case against her abuser. And after we won that case, she became like a family friend. She would drop in by the office every week, check in on me. She brought her new boyfriend to the office, and they would come in and talk about their plans to relocate to New York and that life was going to be great and all this stuff. And I loved her because she was a fighter. You come across a lot of people in the world of domestic violence who have been so victimized to the point that sometimes they can become almost helpless because they don't have access to the financial resources, which is a type of abuse. They don't always respect themselves because they've been talked down to for so long. And they're fearful of every creak or every squeak or anything they hear because they know it's usually associated with some violent act or threat that's coming. But this wasn't her. She was a fighter. And so I knew we won the case against her abuser. Her abuser is probably more scared of her than she is, and she's ready to go. And we were just trying to tie up some loose ends, get her on her way. Well, she was also pregnant, and so they wanted to raise their family in New York. She was from New York. And so one day I come into the office, and when I come into the office, nobody's talking to me. And I can't figure out what's going on, but I had cases, so I walked across to the courthouse, handled my cases. The clerks aren't talking to me. So I say, okay, I wonder what's going on. Everybody's looking at me so sad. I wonder what's going on. Am I getting fired? And then I go up to the seventh floor, and I meet with some other court staff, and one of my colleagues says, I'm sorry to hear what happened. I'm like, well, what happened? And he's like, oh, you don't know. So he pulled up a news story on his computer, and come to find out, this client of mine had been the victim of a murder-suicide while she was giving birth at Forsyth Memorial Hospital. And it was one of those things where I felt a lot of intense emotion. I couldn't figure out, because I said, no, we won the case against the abuser, so he shouldn't even be in the hospital. She had a restraining order. Two, she's a fighter. She would never let somebody do this to her, but for the fact that she was giving birth. It would never happen. And then number three, it's like, well, you know, where was the new boyfriend? Like, what happened? And what I later found out was the person who committed this atrocity was the new boyfriend. So then I felt overwhelming sense of betrayal because he was in my office. Like, he used to hang out with her. I had no suspicion whatsoever that the two of them were in any kind of abusive situation. And he knew better because he was with her. He was her companion for these other cases that we had handled before. So after that, I checked out of DV altogether.
DV is
domestic violence.
Domestic violence.
Court. I checked out. I told my boss I can't do this anymore. And you know, they needed me to continue, so I did take a couple cases there. But it's one of those things where, if you do victims advocacy work, your heart has to be in it. It's very hard for anybody, especially for me as one of the few men who did anything in victims advocacy with domestic violence. It's very hard to come back to that because as a man entering the arena of domestic violence, you're already trying to kind of undo all of this negative energy that has been put out by the men that these women have interacted with. And you feel like, you know, your happy days are days where someone gets a restraining order and can start a new life altogether, knowing that they're still going to have to deal with pitfalls of how do I pay my bills? Where am I going to live? When do I see my kids? But you try to tell them it's baby steps. But when things like this happen, it just reemphasizes that the work that you're doing is very real. And there's this concept called secondary trauma that you oftentimes will take with you. And the more you see that, the more it aggregates and the more you start, I guess, changing who you are in your life. And I never wanted to bring any of that negative energy into my household with my wife, whom I love dearly, and my child. And so I knew I needed to do something different.
So you did something different within that office. And now tell us about your work at the clinic and work to try to mitigate the circumstances around eviction.
So one of the things I did in switching over from domestic violence was doing housing work. And at the time, there was a lot of housing cases, but there weren't a lot of attorneys that were dealing with them. Primarily, I guess the overarching sense was if someone is dealing with an issue with a landlord, they probably don't have the money for an attorney, because if they did, they would just cover whatever issue with the landlord they need to cover. And, you know, everybody who knew me, particularly at that time, I was very big on litigation, probably more so than I needed to be. I would litigate everything. Only because I felt like people didn't necessarily respect your demand letters. Mm-hmm. They didn't necessarily respect the tenant's wish for repairs. But they do respect when they have to pay money out for an attorney over extensive litigation and discovery and ultimately risk losing a hearing. Yeah. And so, you know, I tried to do as much litigation as I could. Well, simultaneously, while I'm at Legal Aid in Durham, there's a guy by the name of Charles Holton who had launched a civil justice clinic at Duke University with the goal being to provide students with an experiential experience of litigation. Like, these are advanced level law students who wanted to see what it's like to be a litigator. And I was one of the attorneys that those students would work with. And part of working with me is I'm very, like I told you before, I'm very people oriented. Mm-hmm. So if somebody tells me that they have an issue going on at their house, well, we need to go to the house. We need to see the issue. We need to take pictures of the issue. And a lot of the times, those involve cases that were public housing. So students who may come from more privileged backgrounds and have never been exposed to any kind of public housing would get in the car with me and ride over to the other side of town and go into public housing units. And I think it was good for two main reasons. Reason number one is it educated them about what people are dealing with outside of some of the concerns that the students may primarily have. So students, you know, as a student, you're concerned about, your career path and your options moving forward professionally. But there are people out here who are concerned about how are they going to eat tomorrow? Like, how are they going to live? So that's one thing. On the other side, as a native of Durham County, it gives me tremendous joy to be able to bring legal acumen to people who otherwise would not have a voice. And these students are amazing. So bringing these students over always gave my clients a sense of pride. Like, I have a Duke person working on my case.
Who has seen a cockroach. How about that?
Right. There's a Duke person who's advocating for me. And there's a sense of validation that came from, you know, knowing that, you know, this attorney and this Duke law student are investigating my claim.
Structurally, does the word get out among the landlords? Look, we can't get away with this stuff anymore. Do things kind of change systemically within the system, knowing that the marshal's in town?
Well, it's an interesting thing. We've had, as part of our awareness campaign, we've met with a lot of different landlord groups. And what we're realizing is there's definitely, landlords are definitely not a monolith, right?
Right.
So there are some landlords who they come to every meeting. They present legitimate concerns. They say, you know, we have to evict because if I'm trying to expand to be able to provide low-income housing to other communities, I need money to be able to float that capital to acquire this other property. And if I don't get it, this out-of-state corporation is going to get it, who's not worried about low-income housing or the community or whatever the case may be. But at the same time, I can't be in a position where I don't get paid the rent because then it messes up what I'm trying to finance. Right. Oftentimes, the landlords who are the problematic ones, they're not coming to the meetings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because of the demographic that they serve, they may not necessarily feel they need to. So some of the things that we used to hear were particularly landlords who serve a Spanish-speaking demographic have threatened to call ICE if anybody presents an issue about any of the conditions that are going on in the unit. So nobody says anything. In addition to that, we were concerned because the eviction judgment that is obtained in small claims court is really the end of the road. There's an appeal process, and it's a de novo appeal process to go to district court. However, you get a new file number there, and for the longest time, the court system did not pair those file numbers together. Mm. So even if you won your case in district court, it didn't do anything to get rid of the underlying judgment. And when you went to go to a prospective landlord and they saw that you had an eviction, nobody cares.
Could affect your credit rating as well?
It's going to affect your credit.
Yeah.
There are a number of collateral consequences. Wow. It will affect, of course, the school district that your kids go to if you're no longer able to stay in that community. It can actually increase the rate of homelessness. It can affect your ability to get employment if you don't have a stable address. So with all these things in the aggregate, what we said is we needed to see what parts can we fix through the litigation process. One of them was getting the small claims judgments vacated in a district court appeal. The other part, though, is to see how many situations we can actually bridge the gap between tenants and landlords who ordinarily would want to be able to negotiate or work things out, but because of the adversarial nature of the system or the statutes, may not feel inclined to do so. And that's how we view our role. We view our role as a problem solver to help people who want to come to the table and work out resolutions do so. But we also view our role as that of, if a landlord is actively doing things that are in violation of the statute and does not wish to participate, we do have that option of being able to pursue litigation against those landlords in order to justify those situations.
And you apparently are the guy who's willing to do it, among others. Jesse Hamilton McCoy II, a housing lawyer, supervising attorney with the Duke Law, Civil Justice Clinic, focuses on eviction diversion and is, of course, aiming to cut down the number of people forced out of their homes. Jesse, what a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You can find out more about his work at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.